refused to answer questions. We know that they said on Sunday he should be out within 2 days. He missed arguments again on Wednesday. The court will not give us any more information. It seems that he's still not participating in arguments, and that's all we know.
Dahlia Lithwick, we want to thank you for being with us. Slate.com senior editor, senior legal correspondent, and Imani Gandhi, senior editor of Law and Policy for Rewire News Group. And that does it for our show. Oh, and some exciting news. Democracy Now!'s YouTube channel has reached a major milestone, 1 million subscribers. Thank you to all of our viewers. We hope more of you will check out our YouTube channel and spread the word. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Show your support for KBOO programming by picking up the special limited edition KBOO Music That Moves You silicone collapsible water bottle. It's the perfect accessory to keep you hydrated while KBOO keeps you moving. Get yours now at kboo.fm/movesbottle.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, accusations of racism as hearings continue over the possible first black female Supreme Court justice. A man accused of killing a woman in a shooting spree in Portland is transferred from hospital to jail. And Portland doctors say they see a dangerous trend of fentanyl abuse rising in the metro area. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 24th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. Doctors are saying that fentanyl abuse is on the rise in our community. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has the story.
Portland doctors working in addiction and recovery are saying that fentanyl abuse is rising in the greater metro area, causing major health concern among those of all ages. The chief of addiction medicine at Kaiser Permanente, Dr. Sarah Leitz, says, quote, "We're seeing a dramatic increase in the number of people using illicit pills, and most of these pills are fentanyl," unquote. Leitz maintains that the Portland area is getting hit especially hard right now and notes that it is increasingly found being mixed into multiple other substances such as cocaine, methamphetamine, and Xanax. Following the recent deaths of two high school students who took fake prescription pills laced with lethal amounts of fentanyl, parents have created a nonprofit called Song for Charlie with the intoned warning that just one pill can kill. The organization is named after the nonprofit's vice president, Mary Ternan, lost her youngest son, Charlie, after he took a counterfeit pill that ended his life in May of 2020. According to the CDC, deaths from fentanyl have more than tripled in the past 2 years, among teenagers nationwide. Medical officials say that substances laced with fentanyl are desirable to those dealing drugs, as the drug produces instant high effects and is extremely addictive, thusly helping cartels move more product. Leitz is urging the public, especially parents with teenagers, to educate themselves on the dangers of using substances not prescribed by a medical professional. For anyone facing concerns about fentanyl abuse or other opioid abuse issues, Oregon has many resources available, including calling 211, Multnomah County Mental Health and Addiction Crisis Line at number 503-988-4888, Clackamas County Alcohol and Drug Treatment Services at number 503-742-5335, and organizations such as Lions for Life, LifeWorks Northwest, Central City Concern, and Safe Oregon, which is specifically aimed at state youth resources. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
The suspect accused of killing a woman amid a mass shooting spree at Portland's Normandale Park has been transferred from a hospital to a jail. On Saturday evening, February 19th, Benjamin Smith approached a march that was held in protest of the police killing of Amir Locke and began yelling at people in the gathering. According to court documents, some members of the protest told Smith to leave them alone, and Smith physically confronted them aggressively. Shortly thereafter, Smith opened fire on the group, shooting five people before Smith himself was shot in the hip from another individual who was present at the scene, as reported in an affidavit and a source with direct knowledge of the investigation. Brandy June Knightley was shot at close range and died at the scene while four others were injured. Knightley, who was 60, was a volunteer with a traffic crew against police violence, while the other four injured people's identities are to remain confidential. One was shot in the neck and is paralyzed in critical condition. The others suffered multiple shots but have been treated and released. Smith is facing 9 charges. Second-degree murder with a firearm, 2 counts of first-degree assault with a firearm, and 2 counts of second-degree assault with a firearm. The person who fired back at Smith was initially arrested, but following GoPro video footage obtained during the chaos, has been released, and according to police documents, faces no charges. A far-reaching conservation program in Washington state receives full funding from Congress. As Eric Tegenoff reports, this means $900 million worth of projects in Washington and across the country, including city parks and public lands, are now funded.
An important conservation program has received its full funding in Congress's budget. The Land and Water Conservation Fund will be able to allocate $900 million to projects across the country that ensure access to public lands as well as for local projects. It's the first time the program has received its full dedicated funding since the Great American Outdoors Act in 2020 saved it and ensured permanent funding. Amy Lindholm is Land and Water Conservation Fund Coalition Manager for the Appalachian Mountain Club.
Every part of the country, every state, every congressional district, nearly every county in America has been touched by investment from the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And, you know, it protects everything from your local parks and playgrounds to working forests to habitat projects.
The program has been around for more than 50 years, allocating more than $700 million to Washington State over that time. It's helped protect places such as Mount Rainier and Olympic National Parks, the Pacific Crest Trail, and Skagit Wild and Scenic River. Lindholm says the $900 million is a great accomplishment and start to more conservation.
But we also see on the ground in Washington that there are projects that are still not able to be funded, and they are urgently needed for a variety of reasons. But given the climate crisis that we are experiencing, they are more important than ever.
Some of the projects on the program's supplemental list in Washington include the Kittitas Working Forest, San Juan Island National Historical Park, and work in the Okanagan-Wenatchee National Forest. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Seattle Pride has cut ties with e-commerce giant Amazon as a sponsor for its annual parade on Tuesday, citing the company's financial support for lawmakers, organizations, and legislation that does not support the LGBTQ community. Amazon has been a past supporter, but presented a significantly higher financial commitment of $100,000 for 2022 Seattle Pride with strings attached. The company requested the annual celebration be renamed Seattle Pride by Amazon. Seattle Pride Executive Director Crystal Mark said following Tuesday's announcement, "This Pride parade is for our community and to celebrate, to remember Stonewall in 1969, and to continue the fight for our rights, and we don't feel it was possible to accept this money." Seattle Pride is accusing Amazon of donating to politicians who are in support of anti-transgender legislation, including two bills introduced in Washington and supporting lawmakers who voted against the Federal Equality Act, which was intended to expand protections against discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. Further demands from Amazon for 2022's Pride included prominent display of their logo, ensuring the company's representation and signage to be larger and more present than other supporters. A further request was to have an Amazon official make remarks at the parade, which historically does not include speeches from corporate partners. Though spokespeople from Amazon have vowed support for the LGBTQ community in the past, Mark summed up this year's cut with the company saying, "There is a high likelihood it came from a place of wanting to support who we are. It was the additional requirements that threw us for a loop, wanting so much visibility at such a high level." Following his meeting in Brussels today, President Joe Biden made comments and answered some questions.
Relating to President Xi Jinping of China, I had a very straightforward conversation with Xi. Now, I guess it's 6 days ago, 7 days ago, in that range. And I made it clear to him, I made no threats, but I made it clear to him that make sure he understood the consequences of him helping Russia, as had been reported and as what was expected. And I made no threats, but I pointed out the number of American and foreign corporations have left Russia as a consequence of their barbaric behavior. And I indicated that I knew how much he, because we had long discussions in the past about his interest in making sure he had economic relations and economic growth with Europe and the United States, and indicated that he'd be putting himself at significant jeopardy in those aims if, in fact, he were to move forward. I am not going to comment on any detail about what we know or don't know as a consequence of that conversation. But tomorrow or next Monday that Ursula is having that conference with China, on April 1st. We've had discussions because I think that China understands that its economic future is much more closely tied to the West than it is to Russia. And so I'm hopeful that he does not get engaged. We also did discuss today that there's a need for us to set up, NATO to set up, and the EU, to set up a system whereby we have an organization looking at who has violated any of the sanctions and where and when and how they violated them. Talked about a significant major U.S. investment, among others, in terms of providing for the need for humanitarian assistance, including food, as we move forward. Tarina of the Wall Street Journal. Watch out, you don't get hit in the head there now.
Mr. President, in your view, does President Zelensky need to cede any Ukrainian territory in order to gain a ceasefire with Russia, or is that completely off the table? And then also, do you think that Russia needs to be removed from the G20?
On the latter point, my answer is yes. That depends on the G20. That was raised today, and I raised the possibility, if that can't be done, if Indonesia and others do not agree, then we should, in my view, ask to have both Ukraine be able to attend the meetings, as well as basically Ukraine being able to attend the G20 meeting and observe. With regard to, what was the first question?
If you think that Ukraine needs to cease, give up any territory in order to get a
ceasefire. That is a total judgment based on Ukraine. Nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. I don't believe that they're going to have to do that, but that's a judgment. There's negotiations that are discussions, I should say, that have taken place that I have not been part of, including the Ukrainians. and it's their judgment to make. Cecilia, ABC.
Sir, you've made it very clear in this conflict that you do not want to see World War III. But is it possible that in expressing that so early that you were too quick to rule out direct military intervention in this war? Could Putin have been emboldened knowing that you are not going to get involved directly in this conflict?
No and no.
I do not believe that. And to clarify on chemical weapons, could, if chemical weapons were used in Ukraine, would that trigger a military response from NATO?
It would trigger a response in kind. Whether or not you're asking whether NATO would cross, we'd make that decision at the time.
And my final question, because you're heading to Poland tomorrow, do you think that getting a firsthand look at the effects of this war on these millions of Ukrainians who have fled their country could change the way that you might respond?
I don't think so, because I've been to many, many war zones. I've been in refugee camps. I've been in war zones for the last 15 years, and it's devastating. And but the thing you look at the most is you see these young children. You see children without parents that are in those camps.
Recently, I talked to Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley. I wanted to find out in general with Ukraine what your thoughts are regarding the direction the country's taken. The president's taken on Ukraine.
Well, let's start with the recognition of how the Ukrainian people have fought to preserve their democratic republic and the freedoms that they experience of freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. They had the Orange Revolution when they had a government that created a fake election, a rigged election, and they insisted on fair elections. They got that fair election. They preserved their democracy. And then they had the revolution in dignity, or also known as the Maidan Revolution, where a president tried to put them under Putin's thumb and the people took the streets and said, no way. And that president fled the country and he was impeached. And again, they preserved their democracy. And they are determined to preserve their vision of government of, by, and for the people against the Putin version of an autocratic dictator running the country, absolutely imprisoning, torturing, and even killing people for expressing their opinion or assembly. So this is a contest, a very dramatic contest between autocracy and democracy. And I'm so impressed by the people of Ukraine. We have to stand with them fiercely, and very pleased that not only have we been able to provide them with extensive weaponry that has helped them take on the Russian invasion, but the American leadership in bringing Europe together, bringing NATO together to provide support. And to have countries like Finland thinking about joining NATO and Switzerland thinking about providing weapons to Ukraine shows the absolute reaction of freedom-loving countries to defend the people of Ukraine. So we have in Congress passed another $13 billion, half to go to humanitarian aid, half to military aid. So we're going to be providing an incredible amount of support to the people of Ukraine. And I think President Biden has gotten this just right, that it is not the role for us to directly engage with Russian troops in the sky or on the ground. That is a formula for a world war and potentially even a nuclear war. We need to be very clear about that line. But while not engaging the Russians directly, we can do a whole lot to help the people of Ukraine.
Yeah, just a follow-up to that with regard to sanctions. Unfortunately, sanctions are punitive, and so they end up a lot of time punishing the citizens of Russia, for example. So I know that's a tool that we're using, sanctions, to try to influence the situation. But at the same time, they can cause a lot of pain, too, and suffering.
Yes, it can. But the people of Russia are currently hearing from their official media, and there's only official media, all kinds of lies, that this was a reaction to Nazism in Ukraine. I mean, just, you know, complete absurdities, that Ukraine was threatening Russia, which is another absurdity. And because Putin has shut down the free press, is controlling the social media, the web, controlling the radio stations, the television, and the newspapers, there has to be a reason for people in Russia to say, what the hell is really going on here? Perhaps the most effective thing that's happening right now is that there are many families that have Ukrainian cousins, if you will, extended family, and the government in Russia can't control the phone call conversations. When people call up and say, hey, dear cousin, dear aunt, dear uncle, dear brother, dear sister, here's what's really going on. Do you know this? You're being completely lied to. And you know, all praise to the woman who stood up with the sign on Russian television and basically said, you're being lied to. I mean, I can't imagine the punishment she will encounter. It was a very courageous act. So it is important for Russia not to kind of just go on with life as usual while they are engaged in war crimes. They are bombing and shelling hospitals and schools, clinics. They are bombing humanitarian corridors for refugees to escape that they agreed to. They are bombing and shelling homes and apartment buildings. To directly and deliberately target civilians is a war crime. This is a horrendous slaughter, and Russia must feel the consequences.
We're heading into the election season, the May primary. We're going to be hearing a lot of messages on our own airwaves, too, here at home. What message would you have for the voters as they go about, for example, choosing the candidates for the next governor of Oregon?
Well, first of all, that we have the fundamental task of addressing health care, housing, education, living wage, jobs, and climate. And listen to the candidates on how they talk about those things and be very aware that we have a big challenge in America of billionaires who can spend hundreds of millions of dollars in dark money on these super PACs. And the ads that they fund will have fancy names like, I don't know, let's just pick something nice sounding like A Better Future for Oregon. But they will be billionaires who are just trying to create government buy-in for billionaires rather than government buy-in for the people. So try to be very discriminating about the social media campaign ads and know that we need to shut down that dark money. That's what my bill, S1, did for the people. It took on gerrymandering. It took on dark money. It defended the ballot box. We fell 2 votes short of being able to have a final debate and vote on it in the Senate. So I'm hoping nationally we will get those 2 votes come the November elections. But here in Oregon, we just have to be on guard about the role, the very corrupting role of anonymous super PACs. You and I, if we donate to a campaign more than $200, we are publicly disclosed. Billionaires doing $100 million of slanderous attacks across the campaign spectrum hide in secrecy. And so that is outrageous and wrong and corrupting, and we need to shut them down. And it's another reason we need to pass the For the People Act.
We'll have one more member of Congress after this coming November election, too, 6 members altogether. What do you think about having that one extra member of the congressional delegation, and how's that going to change Oregon's clout?
Well, of course, these positions are distributed according to relative population size in the country, and Oregon has grown. People across the country are moving here because we are a fabulous, fabulous state, and so it's very appropriate. I think we were first in line to get an additional seat, and I'm delighted to see us have that extra voice in Congress.
KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy skies early, give way to cloudy skies late, a low down of 41. Tomorrow's weather, considerable clouds early, high around 60. The weekend looking pretty nice with highs in the mid-60s, best chance of rain Saturday. Today in history, on this date in 1989, one of the worst oil spills in American history began when the super tanker Exxon Valdez ran aground on Prince William Sound in southern Alaska, eventually spilling 11 million gallons of oil into the water. Our quote of the day is from Bill Maher. You know what happens when windmills collapse into the sea? A splash. The U.S. accuses Russia of war crimes. President Biden meets with NATO allies in Brussels. And it was an emotional day for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson at her confirmation hearing. Here are the stories impacting our democracy in today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The U.S. government assesses that Russia's forces are committing war crimes in Ukraine.
Beth Van Schaik, ambassador for the Office of Global Criminal Justice, announced the assessment Wednesday, citing evidence of indiscriminate attacks against civilians and the destruction of homes, schools, and hospitals. President Joe Biden is in Brussels this week. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan says they'll coordinate with NATO allies on military assistance for Ukraine and sanctions against Russia.
We, the United States, will announce a package of sanctions designations that relate both to political figures, oligarchs.
Tomorrow, Biden travels to Warsaw to discuss the Ukrainian refugee crisis. Meanwhile, there are reports the White House has gathered a team to formulate a response should Russia unleash chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons. The first woman to serve as U.S. Secretary of State has passed away. Madeleine Albright, who was 84, died of cancer Wednesday. Albright was nominated by President Bill Clinton in 1996 after serving as his U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson wiped away tears after an impassioned speech by Senator Cory Booker, who praised her judicial record and, quote, wit and grace in the face of aggressive questioning.
You have earned this spot. You are worthy. You are a great American.
Democrats have heralded the historic nature of her nomination as a black woman, and Republicans have accused her of being soft on crime. Supporters would prefer a bipartisan confirmation vote. However, no Republican votes are needed. Former President Donald Trump revoked his endorsement of Senate candidate Mo Brooks after the Alabama congressman stated Trump had asked him to rescind the 2020 election in recent months. Brooks said he advised Trump such a move was legally impossible. Lawmakers continue to brainstorm ways to help ease the burden of record-high gas prices. The national average is $4.23. Some propose stimulus checks, while others would tax oil and gas companies and use the money for consumer rebates. Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith argues the White House is wrong to blame the Russian invasion for the increase.
Their motive to blame someone else, and they're trying to blame this here instead of acknowledging we made a mistake.
Republicans instead say the shutdown of the Keystone XL pipeline and Biden's policies on oil and gas leases are at fault. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Marcia Fudge unveiled a new plan to address racial bias in home appraisals.
Housing discrimination is not a thing of the past. Issues such as redlining and discrimination in home buying and refinancing are still in our society.
The plan calls for enhanced agency oversight of the appraisal industry to better identify discriminatory appeals and measures to strengthen anti-bias, fair housing, and fair lending training of appraisers. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Protecting the rights of mobile homeowners. It's an idea Colorado lawmakers are looking at. As Lily Bulkey reports, a bill they're considering would cap yearly rent increases in mobile home communities, increase the window of time for people to opt to buy if a park goes up for sale, and put safeguards in place if parks do end up closing.
A bill before the General Assembly would put safeguards in place to promote accountability and affordability in mobile home parks. More than 100,000 Coloradans live in mobile home communities, but investment funds and developers have been buying up parks and hiking up the rent, sometimes by double. Cecia Guadarrama Trejo with Colorado 9to5 says rent increases are the number one concern for residents. She says the term mobile home is in some ways a misnomer because they can cost thousands of dollars to move, maybe too old to survive a move, and it may be hard to find another nearby site.
If I live in Adams County and I have to move my home, if the closest option to me is Grand Junction, that's not where my job is. That's not maybe like where your children are going to school. And so honestly, those options are very, very limited.
Colorado law says rent can be increased once a year with 60-day notice. Trejo notes the bill would cap increases at 3% or 100% of inflation, whichever is greater in a 12-month period. She says it accounts for landlords making returns on their investments while also letting families know what they can expect to pay. Trejo notes that the affordable housing crisis is not just an urban issue, but impacts folks across the state. She says many of those who live in mobile home communities are immigrant families, households with children, veterans, seniors, and people with disabilities.
You know, we're talking about like the most vulnerable populations and about like working class folks. There's a lot of stigma still in miseducation about who lives in these parks, oftentimes because of what they look like on the outside.
She adds that park owners are responsible for common areas and park infrastructure, while residents are responsible for their homes and anything inside. Currently, homeowners have the option of an offer to purchase the park that goes up for sale if they can get 51% support among all park residents and finance the sale within 90 days. The bill would extend that timeline to 180 days and put safeguards in place for if parks do close, landlords would be responsible for paying to move residents' mobile homes up to 100 miles, paying fair market value for the homes, or paying relocation assistance. Jason Legg is an attorney and tenants' rights advocate who works with 9 to 5. He says that without changes, landlords will continue to squeeze homeowners as hard as they can.
The Mobile Home Park Act is a great law, relatively speaking, to like other tenant protection regimes that are out there. And the opportunity to purchase even is great. But so long as rent can be increased exponentially, like it has been, it swallows everything else.
This is Lily Bolke with Colorado News Connection.
The U.S. Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson have included lines of questioning that many see as racially divisive. She could become the first Black woman on the U.S. Supreme Court. As Suzanne Potter reports now, some groups are criticizing the racial undertones at the hearings.
Black leadership groups are speaking out about what they see as racially charged lines of questioning during the Supreme Court confirmation hearing for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first Black woman nominated to become a high court justice. Conservative senators have implied that Jackson may be soft on crime, friendly to terrorists at Guantanamo, and a proponent of teaching critical race theory to kids. Alabama State Representative Wandalyn Givon is president of the National Organization of Black Elected Legislative Women. She says the attacks are hard to watch, but will fade away if and when Jackson is confirmed.
This is a day that we never thought would happen. This is a dream deferred that ultimately came true. We feel this is our moment in time, and you can't take away someone's moment in time.
Asked if the antagonism evident in the hearings will discourage young Black women from choosing a life of public service, Givon says it will only motivate more people to step forward, just as Anita Hill's experience at the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings did in the 90s. Republican senators say their questions are simply meant to clarify Jackson's views and record. Despite Jackson's credentials, the Republican National Committee put her face on a social media ad with her initials crossed out and replaced with CRT. Yvonne says Black female leaders are used to this kind of treatment.
It doesn't matter how smart I am. It doesn't matter what I bring to the table. I'm never going to be considered the smartest one. That's just not the way the world is. The deck is already stacked.